I don't know if this is the easiest time to talk to people after everybody's eaten. But I'm going to try to loosen you up with a joke. So please laugh. There was a candidate for the ministry who had gone through an hour of grueling questions. And one of the members of the candidacy committee said, "I have one more question for you. Would you be willing to be damned for the glory of God?" The candidate thought, "Oh, this must be a trick question." After an hour of grueling questions, he didn't know what to say. Finally, he said, "I'll do you one better. I'd be glad to have this whole committee damned for the glory of God." A few of you have been before committees. What I'm going to share with you tonight is some material that I'm putting into a book that I'm writing for Harper & Row called Defining Yourself, Touching Others, A New Look at Relationships and Spirituality from a Family Systems Point of View. Before I do that, I want to describe something about family systems so this makes sense because I didn't get finished last night. In family systems, it's so important for us to go back to our family of origin and take a look at how the family was structured and what emotional dynamics were taking place. I'll give you an illustration of why family of origin investigation is important by drawing a genogram of a biblical family. And this is the family of Abraham and Sarah. I don't know if you can see it over here, so you're going to have to listen closely. Squares represent males and circles females. This is a line indicating that they are married. And here we have Abraham and Sarah. Late in life, after they had finished sipping their Geritol, Sarah announces to Abraham, "I am pregnant." She has a son called Isaac. Now, an elderly couple having a child that has been waited for a long time, an only begotten son, you can imagine what happened to this child. The child got spoiled. As I will complete the next couple generations, you will see what effect that has in the subsequent generations. Isaac marries a woman named Rebecca, and they're really a good pair because Isaac is a dreamer, a poet, and Rebecca is shrewd. Put them together and they are like a whole person. They have two sons, Esau and Jacob. Esau is an outdoorsman, hairy, takes steroids, pumps iron. He's daddy's little man. He becomes Isaac's favorite. That leaves Jacob for Rebecca, and she becomes mommy's little boy. And Jacob is a wimp, and there's a grace note in that. If God can choose a wimp like Jacob, he can choose the likes of you and me. Whenever things get tough, Jacob starts dreaming. He's crying all the time. And he does anything anyone else tells him to do. He's extremely compliant. Rebecca and Jacob are extremely fused. Well, Jacob, after leaving mother, and this is not too surprising, marries the first woman or falls in love with the first woman he meets, who happens to be Rachel. And of course, he cannot get Rachel because Rebecca's brother Laban is as shrewd as Rebecca. And there's a little waylay here. And first of all, it has to be Leah. And of course, then we have Zilpah and Bildad. I do broken lines because they were maid servants. Okay. Now, who are the favored children of the 12 children born here? Joseph and Benjamin, the children of his true love, Rachel. This is a family, and you can see it in four generations, that has to have a hero, a chosen child, a special child. And it already started back here with Isaac. This is some information you can get when you do a genogram and begin to draw out the dynamics of a family. Now, this family also has a very serious dysfunction in it. You remember early that Abraham and Sarah go into a foreign country. Sarah is beautiful. Abraham is fearful for his life. The king will desire her, so he poses as her brother. And then later on, the pagan king gives Abraham a lesson in morality. Why don't you tell the truth? So right away, we have a family secret. In the next generation, we have the same kind of intrigue and secrecy when Rebekah and Jacob conspire to get the birthright from Esau with the blind Isaac. And later on, you see the same secrecy going on when the jealous brothers bring back the stained coat of Joseph. See, our brother's been killed, actually had been sold away. And you can see again how through the family system, you have secrets. I did this once in a Bible class, and a lady says, "Isn't there something good you could say about this family?" We like to gild our giants. And the first thing that came to my mind is I said, if you had sex at 90, something was pretty good about it. I don't think that's what she was asking for or looking for, but that's what came to mind. Okay, that's family of origin. Now I want to go back to what I was talking about yesterday in terms of separateness and closeness and the extremes of fusion. And what dawned on me one day was, if these are the dynamics that are operative in our relationships, could not these same dynamics be operative in relationships of a higher or deeper kind, those relationships we call spirituality? And this is what I wanted to share with you tonight. When we think of God, we think of a God that is separate, the God who is holy, kadosh. But at the same time, the God who is holy, kadosh, chooses to cut a berith, a covenant, with his people, to come close. The Hebrews call God Yahweh, which means I am who I am, or I will be who I will be, or I am in terms of what I cause to be. Now, that's pretty good self-differentiation and self-definition. I don't know if you could find anything better. So our God knows how to define who that God is. But now the God who is Yahweh chooses to become Emmanuel, which means God with us. Tillich tried to deal with this God who is mostly this masculine other God and talking about the holy other, and made God into the ground of being, the closeness. Or if you have read Rudolf Otto's book, The Idea of the Holy, he talks about God as tremendous. That there's this God that's out there, the God whom we fear and have awe of. And then fascinans, that which goes on within us. So we see these same forces operative in our concept of God, the God who is separate and yet the God who chooses to become close. Now often this creates a problem for people because they become anxious about the God who is absconded to us, to use Luther's term, and yet the God who chooses to be revelatus, the hidden God who chooses to become the God who reveals who God is. And God is a good lover because lovers always make themselves known. And so God reveals himself. Now we have these tensions and it creates anxiety. So for some folks, they want a God who is totally other and totally holy. Others who want God who talk with them and walk with them in the garden and no God who is other. Luther put it in a very fascinating kind of way. He called it fidem contra fide, or fide contra fidem, faith against faith. He said, God is holy, other. Therefore, there is this tremendous, there is this fear of God. Yet at the same time, there is the filial confidence of the believer. And the filial confidence always must overcome that fear of God. So in terms of our spirituality, we are dealing with a God who is other than we are, whose ways are not our ways, whose thoughts are not our thoughts. Yet a God who makes himself known in the person of Jesus Christ and draws near. So we have a tension here, an anxiety. Now along this spectrum, we also have to come across creed, I believe, and commitment. Our relationship with others. We have the same separateness, closeness, forces at work. It's wonderful how Luther put it. We are absolutely subject to no one, our separateness. And yet at the same time, we are totally bonded to others. Bonhoeffer put it in a slightly different way. He said, let him who is afraid of community beware of being alone. Let him who is afraid of being alone beware of community. There is that tension in our life about separateness and closeness on the vertical level. What is also fascinating here is the concept of the church. Paul is a systems thinker. Paul thinks in terms of systems before Murray Bohm was born. Paul says that we are individually separate, members one of another, closeness. It is one body, and yet we all have different functions. In his description of the body, he says, the eye cannot say to the ear, since I am not an ear, therefore I am insignificant, I'm not part of the body. It takes diversity to create the body. And yet in that diversity, you have unity. Paul says the only thing that must be the same, the only thing that must be the same, not function, not identity, but you must have the same care for one another. So Paul catches in his concept of the church these dynamics of closeness and separateness. Let me give you a couple of biblical stories that illustrate these same forces at work. The first one is the prodigal son. Well, the young son goes into emotional distance and cut off. I don't know what unfinished business he had with the father, but like I said last night, if anxiety is not settled in one relationship, it gets played out in another relationship. So when you cut off from the family, you're going to play it out with others. So the youngest son played it out first with prostitutes and then with pigs and the shame of it for a Jew. He went into the far country, emotional distance. Now the elder son is totally fused with his father. All these years I have worked for you, Daddy, and yet you have not even sacrificed so much as a little goat for me. And to top it off, you killed the cow that I was preparing for the 4-H exhibition, the fatted calf, for this son of yours. Okay? And his concept of love is merit, achievement. In fact, all work righteousness is emotional fusion. You are still trying to get the approval, the love, and noticing, and mirroring of someone else that you haven't gotten. And the waiting father, my son was lost. He identifies who he is and who his son is, and he has connection to him. It is fitting to make merry, for us to come together and play. The older son couldn't play. Or you might remember the story of the Pharisee and the publican. The Pharisee is an emotional distance. Thank God that I am not like other men. Remember, the person in emotional distance always gets identity over against someone else. But the publican takes responsibility for who he is, mea culpa, and makes a definition. Or after the crucifixion of Christ, Mary goes out to the tomb to anoint the corpus of Christ. She goes out to define who she is. What happens to Judas? She emotionally cuts off so much that he takes his own life. Peter's out weeping bitterly and says he's going to go fishing. And where are the other disciples? They're huddled in a room, scared in fusion. What happens at this level, in Luther's term, would be people who are fused are seeking securitas, security. People who are in emotional cutoff are in desperation, desperatio. The folks here in the middle live with fiducia, trust. Now, what Murray Bowen says is, we must keep these two forces in tension, which means there has to be a dialectic in life. And when you begin to reduce the dialectic, you're not reducing your anxiety, because you're going to exchange the anxiety that you experience here for another kind of anxiety on either one of the extremes. Now, the whole principle of the dialectical method is that heat produces warmth or light. And if you keep two things in tension, there will be some warmth or light. And we call them creative tensions. But there's also true, they could be destructive tensions, because the heat could turn into smoke and ashes and blazes. And what Murray Bowen says is, the person who is most mature is the person who can deal with dialectical thinking. And if you think of either Kohlberg's schema of human development or James Fowler's schema, you will notice that the fourth and fifth level are the parabolic and the dialectical. Which really says, in order to be a Lutheran, you have to be pretty mature. To be a Lutheran, you need to be able to stand in the midst of all of those dialectics, all those creative tensions. That's why I've said somewhat heretically, Lutherans do not live by faith alone. They also live by indigestion. But what enables us to stay here in the midst of the dialectic is the fiducia, the trust. You know, I was listening to people individually. I listened to people in groups. I even listened to us this morning. And I said, my gosh, what collective despair you can have when you get an assembly of grim Lutheran existentialists together. And I thought to myself this morning, too, how often we operate with the deficit model. Now, I hear that as a therapist, and that's devastating. I didn't get this from the church. I didn't get this from my family. I didn't get this from my spouse. I didn't get this from my pastor. That's all deficit. One of the things that Murray Bowen says, and it's a counteraction to some of the literature of the adult children movement, is that the family is a naturally healing system. That even though the groups you belong to can be dysfunctional and distorted, you can also get blessings. And that's where you get healing. And so I may have been disappointed by people in my life. But that doesn't mean that there is no hope, there's no new life. Actually, all we have to go on, even with our fiducia, is a promise. But I can tell you, other generations didn't have much more. And if you look in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and you look in church history, there are a lot of dysfunctional families. There were people who didn't get a lot of things. But if we keep operating with the deficit model, we will not change. I know that a client who focuses on weakness does not change. The only time we change is when we allow that anxiety to provoke us to look at our strengths. And how do you empower somebody? You empower people by loading them up with options, getting them to look at things in another way and a different way. And at this point, I want to interject another diagram and then come back to this. I want to diagram for you Paul McLean's triune brain. Our brain has three tiers. And each section of the brain has a specific function. There is some overlap, but there are not a whole lot of connection between the three brains. The smallest part of the brain, where the central nervous system hits the brain stem, is called the reptilian part of the brain. This part of the brain is for survival, self-preservation. We share it with lizards and crocodiles and alligators. And it's true. Some folks in the congregation do act like alligators. I don't like the expression because it depersonalizes the individual. This part of the brain must be continuous, repetitive, instinctive, automatic, defensive. Folks who go to these extremes are into reactivity, defensiveness, instinctiveness. They act often like reptiles. You may have driven your car sometimes and you weren't thinking about what you're doing, but all of a sudden your foot puts the brake down. You didn't think about it. It was automatic. I don't suggest you drive reptilian-like, but sometimes it's necessary. The other thing about the reptile part of the brain is it controls respiration. So it must be continuous and repetitive and instinctive and automatic. That part of the brain cannot accept novelty. So again, if folks are on the extreme, they cannot accept novelty. You wouldn't want one lung to say to the other lung, let's be creative and do this in rock time. Now, the next part of the brain, which develops after the first year, and most small children are like reptiles because the rest of the part of the brain hasn't grown. The brain weighs about 3 ounces at birth, about a pound at 1 year, 2 pounds at 2 years, and then by adolescence weighs 3 pounds. But here, most infants are reptilian, instinctive, reactive, automatic. Soon after the first year, the second part of the brain, a little bit larger than the other, which is called the mammalian, or also the limbic system, develops. And it has three major responsibilities: nurture, feelings, and play. In fact, most psychotropic drugs are aimed at the limbic system because it's at that level where feelings can overwhelm people. This part of the brain controls pain and pleasure. Now, a lot of men will say to me, well, I'm not very emotional. I'm wondering if their mammalian part of the brain's been lobotomized. We all have a mammalian brain. The only problem is that most men haven't been nurtured or trained how to use it sometimes, or have denied that part of themselves. Now, it's interesting because this part of the brain composes 15% of the brain mass. 85% of the brain mass is the neocortex, or the cerebral cortex. And the purpose of this part of the brain is to do the thinking, the rationalism, the syllogistic work, seeing things in relationship, imagination. The old bias of the Enlightenment was mind over matter, and that we could use the cerebral cortex to deal with anything in life. But however, now we know that whenever we are under stress or anxiety, we have a reptilian regression. And this part of the brain supersedes or overtakes that part of the brain. Now, the least mature people among us spend too much of their time in the lower part of their brains, the lower 15%. And some lived in families that were very reptilian and mammalian and very little neocortex. And that creates a lot of immaturity. These are the people who get anxious and then go into all kinds of reactivity. That's why we say so often we have to let the dust settle after we've both been reptilian, or we need to let things cool off, because it takes time before we can get back up into the cerebral cortex. But it's in the cerebral cortex where you have novelty, where you have imagination. Father William Lynch has a fascinating book called Imagination and Healing. Unfortunately, it's out of print. But he makes a strong case for the fact that there is little healing that takes place in life if we cannot imagine, if we cannot see new scenarios, if we cannot look at other places. Now, what happens so often in spirituality is today we have a lot of folks proposing spirituality for the reptilian and mammalian system. Because here in a mammalian and limbic system, or the reptilian system, people want comfort and answers. And if you are proposing comfort and answers to people, you are perpetuating their dependencies. To the degree that you can tolerate pain in another person is the degree to which they might grow. To the degree that you can tolerate pain in your own life is the degree to which you will grow. We simply will not change without anxiety. So all of the dialectical thinking and all of those ironical and ambiguous situations are good for us. Anxiety has three purposes, the threefold use of anxiety. And some might question the third use. The first use is that anxiety provokes change. But if that anxiety reaches such a crescendo, it prevents the very change it provokes. So, for instance, as a therapist, I need the client to be anxious. But if the client is so anxious, the client will be so reptilian that there will be little I could do to make an intervention, or to work them up into the cerebrum and get some clarity and some vision and imagination. The third thing would be that anxiety promotes change. But it's just difficult for us to change if we're not anxious. People who take risk, and this is proven by studies, are people who are experiencing pain or anxiety. People who have a clear goal where they want to go and are able to self-define themselves. They are able to risk novelty. They are able to rethink. One of the things that I have been doing in therapy more than I ever done before is I just do circular questioning. I just keep asking questions and questions and questions and questions, because questions subvert the mindset. Questions get folks to see things a little bit differently in the cerebrum. Questions get folks out of all the reactivity from the reptilian and mammalian section. But of course, over here in the extremes, people don't want questions. They want answers and comfort, or they want to tell you what the answer is over here. Now, whether or not the whole society could mature, might has a lot to do with where we are in life today. And I want to illustrate that for you in another diagram. This line here, 100 indicates high responsibility and maturity, 0 indicates low maturity. This line here indicates the conditions of life. Not very severe, 100, extremely severe. People who have a high sense of maturity, low severity of conditions, move on in life and do well with these two forces of separateness and closeness. Folks over here who have a very low level of maturity and very severe conditions in life often become street people, institutionalized, or live in society but function at a minimal level. These are the people that interest me. They have very little maturity, and the conditions in their life are not very severe. But these are the people who are constantly complaining about how hard it is in life, like a lot of us. People up here have a high degree of maturity, and their conditions are more severe than these folks. But the conditions look less severe because of their maturity to handle it. What we know from the stress literature is it is not the amount of stress that creates the stress. It's how the stressee interprets the stressor. And it's in that interaction that determines what the stress will do. Well, of course, if you're highly reactive and you're in your reptilian and limbic system, how are you going to interpret the stressor? You're going to get all anxious and reactive. If you can get more into the cerebrum, you have less of the reactivity. Now, in life, we keep focusing on conditions. And we give labels. And we focus on diagnosis. But diagnosis is a focus on weakness. Diagnosis deals with the deficit model. I have a book called the DSM-3 Codebook, and I have to pick out one of the codes for the insurance company so clients could pay, and pay for the client therapy. And I don't know how many hundreds of codes there are in there. But, you know, there's the paranoid personality, the obsessive-compulsive personality, the schizophrenic. One day Ed Friedman said to me, he said, you know what child rearing is? It's getting your child through the DSM-3 code book. Every child gets paranoid, has a schizophrenic event, is obsessive compulsive at some point, and you just don't want that child to get arrested somewhere. But it's a focus on conditions. A family system therapist would say, we need to strengthen this line. We need to focus on helping people to be more mature, to be more reflective and responsive to life, as opposed to being more reactive and defensive in life. Let's look at Luther's life for a moment and move away from his theology and see how some of these things played out in Luther's life. Separateness and closeness. We don't know too much about Martin Luther's mother. I think her name was Margriet or Margaret. Sometimes it was called Hannah. On several occasions, Luther mentioned that she beat him so severely that he started to bleed. We also know that a couple of Luther's siblings died, in the expression where the babies cried themselves to death. We also know that Luther's father was invited when Luther had his first mass, but for some reason or other, his mother was not. We don't know all that much, but it seems like Luther had a pretty severe and austere mother, as well as father. This has something to say because later in life, what is Luther always warning people against? Anybody know? Do not be alone. Because when you're alone, what happens? You have despair. And you almost wonder if Luther missed some closeness with his parents. And then when you look at Luther's life, I mean, Luther had, he didn't have a family, he had a village. I mean, there were people in the house all the time. He didn't want to be alone. He needed this closeness. And one wonders whether that was missing in his own life. Also, Luther obviously could be separate. Hier stehe ich, Self-definition, self-differentiation, ikon Nick Anders. So he had the capacity to do that and to stand up to the Pope and the world. Of course, he had more difficulty standing up to Katie. Katie and his mother both were strong women. I sometimes wonder, is that why he always liked the Magnificat when you had the nice, humble Mary? Luther also had a lot of illnesses. I mean, to sing a Te Deum because you passed 9 quarts of water, that was one of his illnesses. I often say that if Paul had a thorn in his flesh, Luther had a briar patch. But you see, that anxiety, whether it was from the relationship with his parents, or his own physical ailments, or his own struggle theologically, that anxiety was also his health. For without that anxiety, there would have not been change. There would not have been the willingness to seek novelty. There would not have been the imagination, which he expressed in later times. I'm going to read to you a story, very briefly, written by Frederick Buechner. This is in his latest book, Telling Secrets. In the beginning, he talks about his father's suicide and how all of the unfinished business with that suicide concerning his mother. Then later in life, his daughter develops anorexia nervosa. And he talks about how he got too close and too fused with his daughter. And this is how he describes her illness. Young people crave to be free and independent, separate. They crave also to be taken care of and safe, close. The dark magic of anorexia is that it satisfies both of these cravings at once. By not eating, you take your stand against the world that is telling you what to do and who to be. And by not eating, you also make your body so much smaller, lighter, weaker, that in effect it becomes a child's body. And the world flocks to your rescue. This double victory is so great that apparently not even self-destruction seems too high a price to pay to get those needs met. It's just not a young person's problem. You and I deal with these forces of separateness and togetherness all of our life. And what we would say as Lutherans, pneumatically as well as Bowen would say psychically, is they have to be held in tension. And out of that anxiety comes the growth. You simply cannot grow without tension, without rubbing up against something. You learn to ski by rubbing up against the mountain. Hopefully not a tree. Now, our society, when there is pain, we only ask one question. How can we alleviate it, palliate it, reduce it? We never ask, is there something that this pain might tell me about who I am or what's happening in my life? We never associate understanding with pain. We simply want to take care of the limbic system to reduce the pain. We don't go to the cerebrum cortex and ask people to get some understanding. And yet pain is a teacher without which we cannot live. Pain carries a message, and this is the message theory of illness I'm talking about. It's one part of you communicating with another part of you. It's one part of you teaching you something about yourself. And one thing I've learned as a therapist is that the body is the truest language. The body does not tell lies. We can rationalize, we can deny feelings, but you cannot deny the body. We need the anxiousness. I had a client, and he taught me a lesson which I will never forget. He had moved from the Midwest to the South, and he was again near where his biological mother lived. He had been placed for adoption by his mother. He wanted to find out who she was and where she lived. She discovered where she lived. And he went to visit her. He found her living in poverty, in fact, in a hovel. And when he left, she gave him $2. He went into a tremendous depression to find his biological mother in this kind of condition. He went to a Christian psychiatrist who said, if you had more faith, you wouldn't feel this way. He went to a Christian psychologist who said, if you will come to our Monday, Wednesday, and Friday prayer group, this will disappear. He went to a colleague in the ministry who said, I've never felt that way before, and spent the rest of the conversation talking about the new church organ. He came and he poured out his feelings to me for about an hour, quite emotionally, and then said to me, you are the only one who has allowed me to have my pain, and I have never forgotten that. If I had robbed him of his pain, I would have robbed him of the kairos, of the opportunity to turn that into something new, into something productive, into something that would provoke change. If I have problems tolerating pain in myself, I will collude with you to help you hide it or to trivialize it. Pain gives us a message, something about ourselves, our families, our current relationships. And so often in the church, we are so afraid of suffering and cross, the two marks that Luther adds to the other five marks of the church. We're so afraid of conflict. Shh, don't tell anybody. Don't tell the congregation. Don't tell the children. And we hide that emotional pain. Well, today we have people who are under stress and anxious, and they will get into the reptilian part of the brain and into that limbic system and will be highly reactive. That's life. But what's so important is that you and I grow up, that you and I have the capacity to tolerate that pain and that reactivity and to recognize what it is. It's not always, and even very often, a pain directed to you or to another colleague on the staff. So often it's a pain in life that's being pinned on you, that's being transferred to you. And what we need to learn is not to react to others' reactivity, but to define ourselves to the reactivity. To define ourselves to the reactivity as opposed to the react to it. And I think there's something in this fiducia and this capacity to have a system of belief that enables me to define who I am and to tolerate the pain around me and not to react to it, but to define myself to it. I had a colleague in the ministry who had his third heart attack, and I visited him in the hospital, very popular pastor, and he had about 50 or 60 pastors there. And he said to me towards the end of the conversation, you know, everybody that's been in here has prayed with me. And I like all the prayers. But all clergy get all anxious if they don't do their duty or ritual. And he said, you know, what you did for me was something that was just as important. I had said to them, are you afraid? He said, I'm not afraid of dying, but I am afraid of not having a purposeful life. What he taught me again was to get in touch with that person's pain and be where they are. Because what I learned from Paul, who's a systems thinker, is that the very comfort that we receive, the very mercy, it is with that comfort that we are to comfort the others who are afflicted. In the economy of God, our wounds are social. Our wounds are systemic. And if we can understand ourselves in a systemic way, we can see our wounds will someday be used as a way to heal those who are wounded too. I now have about 10 minutes for questions. Define yourself to the reactivity rather than react to the reactivity.
I don't
understand. Pastor, some people are saying, the reactive pastor says who, when, how many, what. The person who is not pastor's non-reactive says, man, let me finish all of this. Mary, they say the same things about you. We have something in common. What do you think we could do? Where's the responsibility? Back out to Mary. You're not getting stuck with it. You've defined something. Someone gets highly reactive and you go back to a you statement. Or you simply pull back in emotional distancing, and you don't talk to the person. That's reactive. Because either one of these are reactive. Rather than saying, I know that you're angry, and I'd like to hear your anger. That's defining yourself to the person who's angry. It takes a lot of maturity not to be reactive to the reactive. That's why Friedman talks about being a non-anxious presence. He didn't say a non-anxious person. Because when other folks get reactive, you become what? Anxious. But when you're in relating to that person, you must be the non-anxious presence. And I think of the story of the Gerasene demoniac. I love the story because everybody reacts. Even the pigs are reptilian. You know, everybody's reptilian. The townspeople react. The pigs react. The demons react. The townspeople see this man who's healed. And what do they say? Get out of this town. You see, they're in reptile. They can't accept novelty. They have no imagination. And the one who defines himself and is non-reactive is Jesus. Because when the demoniac who is healed says to Jesus, let me go with you, what does Jesus say to him? No. Go to your own folks and tell them what great things God has done for you. No, not keeping dependency, defining himself to the situation. I also like the story where it talks about the sheep who are helpless and harassed. Well, how does Jesus respond? He took compassion on them and began to teach them. Another hand.
You're talking about reacting to pain. Luther has a quote that he said there's three kinds of people reacting to pain. The first kind resent it, resent God for giving it to them, and refuse to learn anything from it. The second group resents God for getting the pain, but somehow learns or willing to learn something. And the third group prays for painful experiences because of what they'll learn from them.
Now, I said diagnosis is on the side of weakness. No, it's looking at how the family structured itself and what were the dynamics in terms of how people functioned. You will find weakness. You will find diagnosis. I mean, dysfunctional family is just a redundancy. What I'm saying is to focus on the weakness, to focus on it, the focus on the diagnosis, you're not going to change. I have a seminary student I'm dealing with, and she's an obsessive compulsive. And she keeps working hard at getting rid of the obsessive compulsiveness. And I said, but you're more than someone who's obsessive compulsive. And like I said last night, you know, think of all the things you get done. You see, if she keeps thinking of that as a label that has identified her total self, it's a symptom of something in her life and her life history. But it's not the total definition of who she is.
I have some comments and a question, but given the time limitation, I'll just ask the question. The question is, what does this say about impiety, which is just the confession of sins, the forgiveness of sins. The confession of sins, the forgiveness of sins. You talk about concentrating on the weakness. Does this explain why traditionally Lutherans have a hard time talking about sanctification?
I'm not sure how you're phrasing that question.
Well, you talk about that people don't change when they focus on the weakness. And yet all of us, hopefully not now, but have experienced a Lutheranism, a piety in our churches, where you never get beyond confessing your sins and being forgiven, only to go through the same thing again and again. And I'm wondering if that doesn't explain why the process of sanctification in terms of our spirituality is really a dead letter, or has been a dead letter.
I see. You're almost talking about confession and absolution is ex operato.
Yeah.
And more than likely, these are people who are fused with God, still trying to get God's attention, mirroring, loving.
I'm just saying, liturgically, traditionally, Lutherans seldom get beyond that stage. Even the highest of celebration, communion, becomes forgiveness of sin.
Mm-hmm. And is sanctification in some ways a maturing?
That was the original meaning.
Mm-hmm.
One part of that family system is Abraham and Sarah. Abraham had another wife, Hagar and Ishmael, and they weren't mentioned in this. I wonder how they did it.
Oh, well, I just wanted to get my point across with the group that I had. I'm very selective. I'm now doing David's family, and that's interesting to deal with Jesse and David and Bathsheba and Michael and Absalom, and I just don't have it ready to present. Yeah, I just wanted to make how it gets transmitted from generation to generation. Okay. But when you think of Murray Bohn's idea of the family as a naturally healing system, wouldn't you reconceive your parish? That if it functions I'm not saying it is a family, but if it functions as a family, it has the potential to be a healing system.
Say that again.
That the congregation has the potential to be a healing system. But it will not be a healing system if it's afraid of anxiety. And it will not be a healing system if there are not some mature individuals in that system. There was another hand. Yes?
You kept talking about reptilian responses. The reptilian part of the brain, I thought I heard you say that you really don't have much control over the functions of the reptilian part of the brain. So what you're talking about is figuratively we become reptilian.
Correct. Our behavior is instinctive, reactive, defensive, which would be no different from a crocodile or a lizard or a snake. I mean, not many folks have lizards for pets because, for one thing, they don't play. They don't have a limbic system. They don't have the brains for it. Pardon?
Do most lizards
fuse? I haven't read much about lizards. Oh, lizard. I see what you're talking about, figuratively, yes. Well, we do know that lizards do not take care of their young. Lizards do not nurture. Okay? And there's not a whole lot of nurturing that goes on in fusion. And there's not a whole lot of nurturing that goes on in distance.
What would the analysis be with Jesus' family?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because Mary gets very anxious at the wedding of Cana. And Jesus says to her, "Woman, what do I have to do with you?" He would not get caught in his own mother's anxiety. And of course, the disciples are constantly getting anxious and reactive. And still, Jesus begins to define himself to their reactivity. We don't know much about father relationship there. Very little is said about Joseph. All right. I want to say something about... My time's almost up. Can I answer this question? All right. You want to hear about what is positive in some of these...
In
the what?
Well, you said to go back to the 10 words, but still try to find something positive.
Oh, okay. I send almost all my clients back home to mother and father, brother and sisters, uncles and aunts. And this is where it all starts. There's an old saying, therapy. If you can tell your parents or anything, you know, you don't have to go to therapy anymore. And even in some of the most dysfunctional families, some things happen. But as long as you're an emotional distance, you will not get that resolved. It'll get played out with other people. And I think that happens in a lot of our churches today. When you have a lot of anxious and reactive people, they're going to play it out with staff people or with other church leaders. And it gets displaced. But the basic thing here is that whatever has been dividing people, wherever the hostility has been, can be lessened. And then you don't need to play it out with other people. And even if the parents are not able to respond, you still have had the capacity to do what with the parents? To define who you are to them. See, this is what you got to remember. You can define yourself to others, but you cannot prevent others from emotionally distancing from you or emotionally fusing with you. But what I keep saying to clients, you have to focus on how you function. I know two people come in for marriage therapy, and he's thinking, well, Pete, if you change her, this marriage would be wonderful. And she's thinking, well, if you change him, this marriage would be wonderful. Well, I'm not going to take the responsibility for changing anybody, and I know it's in the system. And see, you have very little power about changing the other person. And we get into all these will conflicts. If you want to change the relationship, change how you function. And the relationship has to change. Because the other person has to function in a different way with you. Now, it's easier if the two of you come together in therapy or work together on the change. There aren't as many surprises. And you work through it. And this is what we're saying in terms of when other people get stressed or reactive, rather than focusing on how they're functioning, what do you need to do? Focus on how you choose to function in the light of the reactivity. So if somebody is passive-aggressive, somebody is paranoid, somebody is highly reactive, it's only significant if it affects how you function. That takes a lot of sense of responsibility, takes some reflection, takes maturity. So I like to think of therapy not as healing the wounded and the sickos and the flawed and the defective, helping people grow up, to mature, to get in touch with that strength that may be latent that's there. Because if you can load people up with options, you can strengthen them. You can empower them. Well, I'd like to just share with you very briefly my creative illusion. My creative illusion would say, this world needs a lot of mature Lutherans. Thank you.